Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is comedian Gianmarco Sorrese. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and a special visit from composer Dan Asia, discussing his upcoming Israeli Independence Day concert program. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. This week we'll celebrate Israel's 75th anniversary, a big birthday for a pretty young country still. I think it's only after a nation reaches 100 years old and still has the same system of government that you can truly stop talking about just how young it is. There are certain things a country needs to work out over time. And no matter how quickly it develops and advances, and Israel has made astonishing progress in this fairly short period of 75 years, it's only after the passage of a couple of full generations that things truly settle in. Israel has changed dramatically over the 7.5 decades of its existence. The Israel of 1948 had about 600,000 residents. That's fewer than live in 3 Israeli metropolitan areas now. And the population has grown to 9.7 million people, including 7.2 million Jews, roughly half the Jewish population of the whole world. The absorption of immigrant Jews from all over the world has been astonishing. In its 3/4 of a century, Israel has absorbed many more immigrants than it had as original citizens by a factor of 10. It's as though America, in the 75 years since World War II ended, had accepted and successfully integrated 300 million immigrants instead of the perhaps 30 million who have actually arrived here. In 1948, the new nation of Israel was frankly a poor country economically, and it remained so throughout the 50s, 60s, 70s, and even 80s. It was a second world kind of country well into the 1990s when I lived there, when the economy dramatically expanded in the late 90s and 2000s and forward. And today it is decidedly a very first world nation indeed, similar to Italy or Spain in its living standards. Israel's status as startup nation is pretty well documented and earned, as the Israeli high-tech sector is acknowledged throughout the world as a center of innovation and economic development. Israel's also on the leading edge of medical technologies and treatments. Israel may be the world's most advanced country in strategic and technological water resource use and development, as well as desert agriculture and solar power. Israel's become a regional economic powerhouse on the level of highly developed European nations. It is the envy of its Middle Eastern neighbors. Militarily, for the first 3 decades of its existence, the nascent Jewish nation was under existential threat of destruction. That was true from the time of 1947's UN partition plan until the Camp David Accords in the late 70s, which meant that until then, any war could be the one that led to Israel's annihilation and the murder of all Jews living there. And there were 4 such wars, each of which ended with Israel victorious, but always at a high price. But with peace treaties with Egypt, then eventually Jordan, and of course the incredible development of the Israeli military and intelligence organizations, as well as the various industries and government entities associated with them, Israel has never been more secure militarily than it is now. Diplomatically, Israel was incredibly isolated throughout most of its early history. The UN vote might have more or less legally created the country. That was the first time the UN ever voted to form one, and it is still one of only a small handful of nations that have been internationally invented by the UN. But Israel was something of a pawn in the Cold War battle between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. From the 40s to the 70s and 80s, the Arab League boycott of Israel was in full force. It only lost its economic teeth during the Oslo process of the 1990s. The disappearance of the effectiveness of the Arab League boycott certainly helped with the Israeli economic surge of the 90s and 2000s, fueled by the new treaties of the Oslo process and the rapid pace of investment and development in highly educated Israel. With the Abraham Accords of just a couple years ago, Israel's integration into the international community has never been more developed. While far from complete, Israel is more widely accepted and influential than it has ever been. So politically, how's Israel doing, you might ask? Isn't it tearing itself apart over political and religious divisions now? Isn't it on the verge of a widely predicted civil war? Well, no, not at all. Israel's experiencing widespread peaceful protests over key political issues, the independence of its judiciary, limits on executive authority. Like open, liberal, orderly societies, it has a vibrant free press and a great tradition of vigorous public debate and protest. But Israel is nowhere near a civil war or anything like it. For a 75 years young nation, it is doing just what it should do, hashing out important issues publicly and peacefully, if loudly. Are there problems in Israel? Sure. The Palestinian issue is not going away anytime soon. After 55 years, the West Bank is no more fully integrated into Israel than the Gaza Strip was before Israel walked away from it under Ariel Sharon. There is growing economic inequality in a nation that started out socialist and egalitarian. There is undoubtedly a religious secular divide, and an ultra-Orthodox Haredi versus everybody else divide too. There is some political corruption. Imagine that. The cost of living in Israel is very high, and my goodness, they have traffic problems in their major cities. Terrorism is always a disturbing threat, although it actually impacts very few individuals. And the level of stress in Israeli society is just as high as you might expect at a Jewish country. And Israeli politics is pretty crazy, which, coming from an American in 2023, is really saying something. On balance, Israel is doing amazingly well, and absolutely should be celebrated on this, the occasion of its 75th birthday. Look, before we reached a century old, our own United States fought a brutal civil war that killed, 15% of all the young men in the entire country. I mean, brutal human slavery was legal, widespread, and flourishing in America until we were nearly 90 years old. And of course, when America turned 75, women still couldn't vote or own property or hold public office, and that lasted nearly another 75 years, and the original owners of the continent, Native Americans, were being herded like cattle onto reservations and hunted, starved, and massacred. When America turned 100, Jim Crow laws were established all across the South, which turned blacks into, at best, second-class citizens, while Chinese immigrants were being ruthlessly exploited and brutalized. When we turned 125 years old, strike-breaking in America resulted in the massacre of a good number of striking workers. Child labor was ubiquitous, and American cities were almost literally cesspools of congestion, pollution, and disease. Well, we grew up as a nation, and for all of our weirdnesses and social challenges, we fixed a lot of those horrible problems. And Israel will fix its problems too. They are nowhere near as hard as the problems it's already overcome so magnificently. Israel's an amazing country, and Jews everywhere should be proud of it, especially this week of its 75th birthday. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is a terrific young Jewish comedian, Gianmarco Cerezi. Here's a bit of his stand-up comedy.
I'm from New York City, We thank you. It's good. It's good. I get a lot of my material just from living there. You know, like I was on the train once. This is a true story. I was on the train. There was a couple across from me. The man said to the woman, "What do you want to do for dinner?" And I swear to God, the woman said, "I think that lanky Jew is listening to our conversation." I am Jewish. I don't make a big deal out of it unless I'm losing an argument with a person of color. But I did have a German bartender once, and somehow it came up I was Jewish, and immediately he was like, "I am so sorry for the Holocaust." Which threw me off guard. Like, how am I supposed to respond to that as a Jew? No worries. Don't let it happen again. I didn't know, so I just said, "Could I get a free beer?" And he was like, "I would, but my boss would get mad." I was like, "I get it. You're just following orders."
Now that's funny. To play us in on Too Jewish this morning, on this week of Israel's 75th anniversary, here's the late, great Ofra Chaza in her Eurovision-winning performance of the song Chai, Life. It was sung at the time in Germany at the contest with a group of backup singers wearing yellow, just to remind people of the yellow stars of the Shoah and how we were still here and vibrant and vital, affirming the vitality of Israel and Jews everywhere. ולפני שנים רבות מספור אני שואל ומתפלל טוב שלא עבדה אותה תקווה עובר מזמור מדור לדור ממעיין מאז ועד עולם אני שואל That was Ofra Chaza singing Chai for Israel's 75th anniversary this week, Life, a song of my grandfather and father, and now it's my song. Our guest this morning, delightful young Jewish and Italian comedian, joins us, Gianmarco Sorresi. Meet him when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish a terrific young comedian. Gianmarco Sorresi is Jewish and Italian, which comes out in his comedy. He's going to be appearing in Chandler, Arizona very shortly. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Shalom. Thanks for having me.
Shalom. So what made you become a comedian?
I was failing at acting. people ask me, how's the acting career going? I'm like, I don't know, how many times have you seen Meryl Streep headline in Arizona?
The combination of being Jewish and Italian is unusual. I mean, there are 10,000 Jewish comedians, many of them really fantastic. There are some Italian comedians. Tell us how this comes together for you.
So for me, my mom is Jewish. She grew up in Little Israel, which, as you know, is the Hebrew for Long Island. And then my dad's like kind of Italian, but he exaggerated it. If people just know my name, they think I'm, you know, from The Godfather or something, but I'm very Jewish. You can feel it.
I don't want you to have to give away your best routines, but I really thoroughly enjoyed watching some of your stuff online on YouTube. And my son is fortunately has a day job, but he's an aspiring stand-up comedian. He know a lot of your stuff. What kind of job is this for a nice Jewish boy?
Oh, well, you'll have to ask a nice Jewish boy. Honestly, it can be fun. I travel around the country to a lot of places where there's not a lot of Jews. And it can be fun sometimes, I think, to educate people in a funny way or deal with. Like, I recently was in Orlando, Florida, and I said on stage, I'm Jewish. And someone in the audience went, yuck.
Ooh.
And you know, I'm a comedian, so I was like, joke's on you, that's Hebrew for great job. And that's a fun challenge as a comedian. Obviously, I worry sometimes, but it's fun to bring a different perspective to some parts of America and win them over through comedy.
We will talk much more with comedian Gianmarco Ceresi here on Too Jewish when we come back in a moment. He will be in Chandler, Arizona shortly. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the entire metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Religious school is going for school-aged children and grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, Torah Tykes experience, confirmation, and teen programs. All in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Come in person Friday night or Saturday morning. Go to the website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Friday night services, Shabbat celebration is at 6:30 p.m. with full music. Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m., preceded by Torah study at 9 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our Facebook page, BeitSimcha Tucson, has all of our services as well, and our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. Go to our website to sign up. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, Torah Tykes, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. That's BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and the fastest growing Jewish congregation and community in all of Arizona. We are delighted to have a special visitor this morning on Too Jewish, Professor Dan Asia, who has composed and created a musical celebration for Israel's 75th anniversary coming up soon. Good morning. Welcome, Dan.
Good morning to you, Sam.
So, where's the inspiration musically? You write really very contemporary stuff. Where did you look to find a way of expressing this wonderful simcha of the 75th anniversary?
My music comes from everything that I've experienced and everything I've heard during my life. So like most American composers, that means growing up with American popular music and jazz, which I played as a youngster, both on trombone and guitar. And then, of course, since Judaism has always been such a major presence in my life, it's present in really almost all of my music, whether it's specifically Jewish or not. A lot of my music is set with Jewish texts, but other pieces, for example, like my piano concerto, when Andre Michel Shub approached the second movement, he said, "Oh, I get it. You want me to play this like I'm a cantor?" And I said, "Yep, that's the way you should play it."
In the interest of full disclosure, I'm singing on one of the pieces of Birkat Kohanim, A Priestly Blessing. Were you trying for sort of a more Israeli sensibility in your work? Not necessarily on just the Birkat Kohanim, but on all the music you created for this?
Not necessarily. The Birkat Kohanim was written for my daughter's bat mitzvah, which is already about 20 years ago. And but some of my music, that's a question, you know, what is Israeli music? What is Jewish music? What's the effect of klezmer? What's the effect of cantorial singing? These are all different traditions, I think, that come into play. But the Birkat Kohanim was meant to be approachable, accessible, something that could be performed as part of a service. And therefore, it's rather traditional, although it still has some intervals that are harder to sing, as I'm sure you've discovered.
Yeah. I would vouch for that. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, but then work out quite nicely and resolve very, very gently. You know, some of my music, for example, like Chagiga, which was commissioned by a synagogue in Springfield, Massachusetts, and a wonderful cantor named Morty Shames.
Oh, I knew Mort Shames well, by the way. He was very important in the Cantor's Assembly when I joined about 8 million years ago. Very lovely guy.
Well, Sam of a blessed memory was a wonderful guy. Morty
Shames.
Getting confused between my Mortys and my Sams.
Yeah.
And that piece for him, you know, look, it's based on sacred texts, and sure, it incorporates some Israeli sensibility. And it, again, incorporates also cantorial sensibility. So it's a combination of the two, but of course filtered through who I am as a composer, which is the effects of studying Beethoven, Mozart, Haydn, Stravinsky, and looking at the artwork of Rembrandt and Picasso. And all of those things go into a composer's output, what happens in his or her music.
Dan, tell us about the event that's coming up, how people can attend, and what it's going to be.
So the event is Tuesday night, April 25th. It will be at 7 o'clock at Holdsclaw Hall, which is in the Fred Fox School of Music building at the southwest side of the University of Arizona campus, right off of Speedway and Park, for those who are local. 7 o'clock to about 8:15. It's an interfaith event. There will be many rabbis there, many priests and ministers, and representatives from various parts of the Jewish community. And there will be about four or five people representing those communities who will speak quite briefly.
God willing, as we say in my business.
And then that will be in part going along with performances of three of my pieces. One is called Why Jacob, which is written in memory of a childhood friend of mine who was one of the first soldiers to die in the October 73 Arab-Israeli War, which is just 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And then a set of songs called Amichai songs, based on poetry by the wonderful Israeli poet
Yehuda Amichai, of course. Yeah.
And then finally, Psalm 30. And the three participants in the performances are my colleague Dan Linder at the university, who plays piano gorgeously, Stephen Merkel, who was the concertmaster here at the Tucson Symphony and then the Phoenix Symphony, and is now up at NAU where he teaches violin, and Jeremy Hugh Williams, who will be joining us from Wales. And Jeremy has been an advocate and proponent of my music for about a decade now, so he's flying over for this special event. So the event, just so everybody understands, is going to be celebrating both Yom HaZikaron, which is Remembrance Day, which is the day that we'll be doing the concert, and then the next day, which is Yom HaTzma'ut,
Israeli Independence Day.
Independence Day. So we'll be going from one to the other. We'll start with what I'll say is a surprise, which will remind us of how Israelis celebrate Remembrance Day, and then go into the concert.
Dan, thanks so much. We're looking forward to it. And, you know, Chag Sameach, of course, for what will be a powerful but also a wonderful celebration.
Well, thanks so much. And remember, have a little honey the day of the concert. We're expecting your sweet boy.
Thanks again. The program will be this Tuesday, April 27th at 7 p.m. at Holzclaw Hall at the University of Arizona in the Music Building. It's free and a fabulous way to celebrate Yom Ha'atzma'ut. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, JewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, 2JewishRadio.com, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 200,000 downloads on Podbean, and now on Spotify, too. Post a rating, review 2Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We are approaching the 75th birthday of Israel, the great 75th anniversary coming up very soon. And we started talking last week about the role of Jewish educators and leaders in promoting Israel, and then kind of got into the broader question of the importance of vital diaspora communities and what that means. And I guess I would say vital non-ultra-Orthodox diaspora communities, because some of the ultra-Orthodox communities are flourishing, but it's the much larger body of Jews who are not ultra-Orthodox, who are not necessarily supporting institutions in the same way or supporting Israel in the
same way. They're increasingly unaffiliated. And I think this may just be a personal bias, but since I come from an Ashkenazic background and my maternal grandparents both spoke Yiddish at home, I think the disappearance of Yiddish is a kind of threat or a sign of harbinger, if you will, of the ultimate disappearance of Jewish communities in North America. I mean, think of Canada. There used to be these communities in Saskatoon and whatever in the Prairie provinces, Winnipeg, that were largely Yiddish-speaking, and nobody there speaks Yiddish anymore except people who are in senior living centers.
But isn't that really a function to a large degree of what generation the immigrants are? I mean, they spoke Yiddish when they came to a country because that was their language of origin. And when they moved, and gradually they learned English, but their children started in English and knew a little bit of Yiddish. You know, it's funny. I was watching just a silly TV show, and somebody said, "Oy vey," and the person who's supposed to be their sister, they're supposed to be Jewish, said, "Oh, now you're speaking in Hebrew." And I thought, boy, I mean, they have somebody Jewish involved in making this show, but they don't quite get it, do they?
Right. A lot of people confuse Yiddish and Hebrew. But, I mean, look, in Montreal, you can still take Yiddish in high school. But that's one of the few places in North America, certainly in Canada, where that's the case. And I think that language does something to define and vitalize a community, to energize a community, because it's also a sense of humor. It's also jokes. It's also slang. It builds a sense of identity which starts to be lost when the language goes away.
You know, it reminds me of Robert Klein, past guest of Too Jewish, our 10th anniversary host and so on, who used to say he loved, you know, and he was working in the Catskills and he was learning from all these comedians in the Jewish Borscht Belt, and they would tell this great joke and then they would finish with chabda, 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 and he would have no idea what the punchline was because it was in Yiddish and he didn't know Yiddish. Right. I think that that's it. We say Yiddish is the ever-dying language, right? That's the old joke about it, because for generations, everybody's predicted the end of Yiddish. It has survived among the ultra-Orthodox who use it as their spoken language, some ultra-Orthodox Jews. It survives on campuses where it's been revived as a very important language to study in your second year.
But in many cases, you're talking about non-Jews in
that's
Poland and Germany.
Fascinating,
and
isn't
it? The vast majority of people who study Yiddish on a higher educational level and who create new Yiddish literature are non-Jews.
If only Israel had chosen not Hebrew but Yiddish, there was a debate about that early on in the Yeshuv, then we would be having this conversation in Yiddish actually right now.
Probably.
We will talk some more next week, Tom, about kind of the broader implications of the 75th anniversary of Israel and what it means out here in the diaspora too.
I look forward to that.
Thanks, Tom. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A man finds out he has only 6 months to live. Understandably, he gets depressed. Realizes if he doesn't snap out of it, his last days will be terribly depressing. He goes to a psychiatrist for help. Psychiatrist, after carefully exploring all the possibilities, says to the guy, "I suggest you go marry a Jewish woman and move to Omaha." The man questions the psychiatrist. He reminds him he only has 6 months to live. The psychiatrist responds, "I know, but it will seem like forever." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. My apologies to Omaha and all Jewish women. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the double portion of Achremot Kedoshim, which includes the Holiness Code, a description of the ethical injunctions that are at the heart of Jewish practice. The code itself includes mitzvot that require us to assist the poor, treat strangers, widows, and orphans with generosity and kindness, and insists on fair business practices. It obligates us to live moral lives. It's important that this remarkable section comes in the precise center of the middle book of the Torah, Vayikra, Leviticus. Kedoshim, the Holiness Code, is in the middle of the middle of the Torah. That is, it forms the heart of our most sacred text. And at that heart is the ethical injunction to love your neighbor as you love yourself. This is an amazing, perhaps utopian ideal. Love your neighbor as much as you love yourself. If our society was actually rooted in such a concept, how much better it would be. In a world in which violent wars tear apart nations like Ukraine, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Sudan, in which desperate refugees from famine and evil are turned aside from rich nations, where terror attacks can strike anywhere at any time. The idea of loving one's neighbor as oneself may seem visionary. How can we believe in such a concept in a world in which horrible human violence can destroy anything? Can this utopian ideal of true love for all possibly be made real? In true Jewish fashion, Kedoshim does not treat this as simply an idealistic statement. Instead, it is made into a practical imperative. Achrimot Kedoshim builds up to the religious commitment with a series of ethical injunctions. Leave a corner of your field for the poor and the stranger. Don't leave a stumbling block before the morally blind. Care for the widow and the orphan. Be honest in your business dealings. Have equal weights and measures in your work. Be holy because God is holy. That is, be ethical, because that is at the heart of holiness. The way to love your neighbor is by treating him or her both fairly and honestly. It is that notion of the pragmatic approach to love that is just so Jewish. We are not obligated to convert our neighbors to our own view of things. We are not obligated to save our neighbors from their own belief systems. We are not obligated to change our neighbors into carbon copies of ourselves. Rather, we're commanded to treat them as we would wish to be treated. Respectfully, honorably, honestly, charitably, compassionately, generously. That is love of one's neighbor as expressed in a functional, healthy society, or a synagogue, or a Jewish community. May we all be able to live to this great ideal in the small, practical, honest ways that truly matter. When we return in a moment on Too Jewish, our guest this morning, comedian Gianmarco Cerezi, both Jewish and Italian, a fun combination, will hang with us. Meet him again when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Enrollment in supplemental Jewish schools, that is, religious schools and Hebrew schools that students attend in addition to regular school in public or secular private schools, is down by nearly half over the last 15 years, according to a new study released last week. Even as the estimated number of Jewish children in the United States rose by 17% between 2000 and 2020, enrollment in religious and Hebrew schools fell by at least 45% between 2006 and 2020, according to the report by the Jewish Education Project, a nonprofit promoting educational innovation that supports Jewish educators in a wide array of settings. The report identified pockets of growth, mostly in the small number of programs operating outside of or adjacent to synagogues, and in schools operated by, this is no shock, Hasidic Chabad Lubavitch movement. But overall, according to the report, just 141,000 children attend supplemental Jewish schools in the U.S. and Canada. That's down from more than 230,000 in 2006 and 280,000 in 1987. Some of the decline in Hebrew school enrollment is countered by increasing enrollment in Jewish day schools, where students study Jewish topics for at least part of, often half, of every day. The number of U.S. children attending Jewish day schools has risen by roughly the same amount, 90,000, that Hebrew school enrollment has fallen since 2006, according to the report. However, a significant portion of that increase stems from population growth in Orthodox communities. They do have a lot of kids, where the vast majority of students attend day school. We believe that many factors have led to the decline in enrollment of students in supplemental schools in the last decade, said David Briffman, the Jewish Education Project CEO. However, it's a myth that all supplemental schools don't work. The group is planning a series of online sessions with some of the dozens of researchers and practitioners involved in the report. One goal is sharing success stories identified by the survey. There are six they identified in the report. Boy, that's not that many. But a common theme of them is urging experiential community-based learning. Some of the promising models explicitly position themselves as infusing Jewish content into childcare, filling a pressing need for American Jewish families. Still, it may be hard to counter the demographic realities of contemporary American Jews. Just a third of U.S. Jews in a 2020 survey said somebody in their household was a member of a synagogue. That was the case even for the majority of non-Orthodox Jews who said they identified with a particular denomination, a marker of traditional engagement. The waning of synagogue affiliation is borne out in the Jewish Education Project's report. It found that more than 700 supplemental schools shuttered between 2006 and 2020, most outright, though as many as 200 survived in a new form after some merger. Miriam Hellerstern, a professor at Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion, one of my alma maters, who was tapped to help design the study, said the results suggest that, as with many aspects of religious life today, Hebrew school enrollment cannot be counted on as an act of obligation or tradition. There's this idea parents send their kids to Hebrew school because they went to Hebrew school. It's a rite of passage in North America. But that's probably a myth. People don't want to push their kids to have to do the same thing they did necessarily anymore. Stern said the report points to gaps in the way the American Jewish communities allocate their resources. Supplementary education really was abandoned as a communal priority, she said. Individual communities had to find ways to fund it on their own, and I think that's part of why we're seeing a decline. Briffman said he's optimistic both about the power of supplemental schools and the potential for them to generate new support from Jewish donors. The Jewish Education Project sought outside funding to pay for its own study and failed. But now that the numbers are clear, he's beginning to see interest from philanthropies. That is, when things really are dire, well, maybe they'll help. This is no surprise to those of us who work in the field of Jewish education in America. Federations and major Jewish philanthropies have long preferred to fund, well, themselves, their buildings, and crazy long-shot efforts at attracting people to Jewish efforts devoid of content, rather than supporting the existing educational institutions with actual dollars. That has meant underfunded educational organizations, synagogues in particular, that make do with volunteers and underprepared college-age teachers devoid of real teaching expertise. It has made religious schools and B'nai Mitzvah experiences expensive for young families who are making choices on how to spend their quote-unquote discretionary funds. The end result of all this? An aging Jewish community with the means to make a difference that is instead investing in all the wrong things and allowing its own future to disappear before its eyes. Jewish philanthropies and federations should wake up and change course and aggressively fund Jewish youth education before they finish allowing the best way to build Jewish future community to simply evaporate, and before their own children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren just walk away from Judaism. And that's the news of Jews around the world. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs. in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We are delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Jen Marco Ceresi, is a terrific young comedian, Jewish and Italian. Is it funnier being Jewish or funnier being Italian?
I think being Jewish gives me access to more jokes that about Jewish people. You know, anyone can joke about Italians because they're fine. So everyone can go, it's a me, a Mario. But being a Jew, I get to really touch some delicate topic matters, and that's fun as a comedian.
I do remember people doing those kinds of, you can joke about Italians, absolutely. They're just going to shoot you in the head later. That was sort of...
Yeah, that's the old Italians, not anymore. Not anymore. What are they going to do? They're going to come over, screw up your plumbing?
or hit you with a Fendi shoe or something. I don't know. Where do you get most of your material?
I think about my childhood a lot. And I compare that to, like, you know, both my parents are single right now. And that is a wealth of material. The other night, my mom went on a date with some guy from eHarmony. And I asked her, I was like, how'd the date go? She was like, let's just say... we're physically compatible. And I was like, let's just say fine next time. How about that? You know, Mom, it's stuff like that. I just take their phone calls, get out a pen, and I write out my next hour of material.
I don't know that I'd want to hear about my parents' hookups. It just seems not really something attractive to contemplate.
Sure. It's not what I wanted, but it's the life I've been handed. My dad, he's got a new girlfriend, and we have a lot in common, like being born in 1988. And it's just weird. He likes dating younger. I like dating older. I mean, once we went on a double date, it looked like the family dinner I'd never had.
And in doing stand-up, I mean, I'm sure you keep a book. You try out jokes. How do you know when a joke's really going to work?
I will run it by my girlfriend. I will try it at a show that doesn't matter. And if a couple people laugh, I go, okay, there's something there. There's something there. But my girlfriend's a really good radar. She's also Jewish, which I had to do. I went on a date with a Catholic once. And I remember she asked me if I went to a Jewish church. And I was like, sweetheart, they're called delis. and of course, like, that's an example. I ran that by my girlfriend. She laughed. I go, okay. That, I think it's going to work.
It's in the act, absolutely. Where's your favorite part of the country to play?
I'm still learning. Like, I'm slowly learning, relearning all the geography I knew in third grade, traveling to a new state each weekend. But especially since it's just winter, when I was in San Diego, it was pretty stunning. I the older I get, the more I think, oh, I get why people move to warm places. I don't know how many more New York winters I have in my system.
I think it's genetically engineered. At a certain point, everybody in New York is forced to move to Florida. It's like a law.
Sure.
What's the weirdest thing that's happened to you on stage?
It was kind of on stage, but I got hired way too early in my comedy career to do a roast for some 50-year-old man for his second wedding bachelor party. And I prepared all these jokes. I did an interview with his son. I was ready to do it. And when I got to this place, I started the jokes. And it was like at a steakhouse. They were all dressed in shorts and t-shirts. I wore a suit because I thought it was going to be some kind of like Friars Club roast or something.
Right.
And the moment I said the first joke, it was something like, he was a big guy and this was a roast. So I said, you know, like, Gary's the kind of guy you don't want in front of you in line at Dunkin' Donuts. He can never decide how he wants to get diabetes. And immediately he was like, hey, hey, enough with the fat jokes. And I'm looking through my cards like, enough with the fat jokes. This is all I have for the next 30 minutes is a bunch of fat jokes. And then I made some joke about his fiance. I was like, you know, Donna always dresses to the nines to make up for the fact that she's a four. And he was like, hey, her son is right over there. And I was like, what, am I roasting the queen over here? What are all these rules? And it was the worst show. I thought they were going to pay me. I did so badly.
Do you remember the flops better than the hits? Did they stick with you more?
For sure. All the hits, they blend together. But the times you're on stage and you take a risk, that's when you... I had one, another one recently. It was, I'm a liberal New Yorker, and I performed for this corporate gig that it ended up being for a very conservative organization. And when they brought me on stage, they said that the only reason I was there was because of a generous donation from their sponsor, ExxonMobil. And you know, my head, I was like, you know, what would Richard Pryor do? What would George Carlin do? Oh, but God. I didn't have any cocaine. So I went up there and I made some joke about like, this is a real thing. There's a billionaire who's recreating the Titanic. And I said, it's going to go along the exact same route as the original because the icebergs got a lot smaller thanks to my sponsor, ExxonMobil. And that audience just started like, first it seemed like they were laughing, but then it turned into a boo, just a big building boo. And I'll never forget that.
All right, last question. What's your best clean joke this morning?
I'm Italian. If you don't know Italians, we're very physically affectionate. We hug, we kiss, we get fired for it. But it makes people uncomfortable. Like my roommate's not Italian. I remember the first time my roommate saw my Italian father and I kiss each other goodbye. He was like, ew. Do you kiss your dad in public? And I was like, yeah. You know, it'd be weird if I only kissed him in private.
Gianmarco Ceresi, thank you for a fun visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to see you and find out more about you?
Well, I'm going to be in Arizona, so come to that. I promise I'll tell all my clean jokes and then all my dirty jokes right after that. And then otherwise, find me online at Gianmarco Ceresi. And my podcast is called The Downside. So if you like Jewish stuff, we didn't even mean to, but it's a show where people complain and kvetch and moan, and you'll love it. The Downside with Gianmarco Ceresi.
By the way, I'm always ready, available to do a retroactive bar mitzvah, but not a retroactive bris. I just wanted to share
that. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Gianmarco. Take care.
Take care.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Frederick Branfun, author of Intimate Strangers, A History of Jews and Catholics in the City of Rome. Really fascinating. And come to Congregation Beit Simcha every Friday night for services and Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, live in person, and on our Facebook page. Our playout this morning for Yom HaAtzmaut this week, Israel's 75th birthday, is the classic Ein Li Eretz Acheret by Gali Atari. I have no other country. My friends, Chag HaAtzmaut Sameach, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace. Ben lev ra'iv kanu be
להזכיר לה להשאיר כאן באוזניה עד שתפקח את עיניה.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.